supposed to sail through that?
Orpheus asked.
How?
Jason felt pretty shaky himself, but he had to look confident for the crew.
We'll send one of the doves through the channel. We'll time how long it takes. If the dove makes it safely, we can too.
And if the dove doesn't make it?
Asked Polydeuces.
Then we wait for another day. Or we try to go overland. Or, I don't know. But the gods will be with us. We've come this far. We could do it.
The crew didn't look convinced, but they moved the Argo a little closer to the clashing rocks. As soon as Jason judged that the cliffs were as far apart as they were going to get, he released the first dove. Just as Phineas had predicted, the bird flew straight for the channel as if its tail feathers were on fire. Argus kept count.
One Mississippi, two Mississippi.
He got to 30 Mississippis before the cliffs slammed together. The crew hung on as another wave crashed over the ship. When the rocks parted, the Boreads flew to the entrance of the channel to look for signs of the bird. When they returned, their faces were grim.
A little stain of feathers and blood on the side of the cliff, Zades reported. The bird made it halfway through, then splat.
The crew winced in unison.
We'll try again tomorrow morning, Jason said. And the next morning if we have to.
What if we run out of doves? Asked Atalanta. We could always send one of the Boreads through, suggested Orpheus.
Shut up, Orpheus, said Calais.
The next morning, Jason got everybody ready. The crew manned the oars just in case they got the go-ahead. The Boreads hovered near the cliff so they could watch the bird's progress. Argus was all set to keep count. Jason waited until the cliffs were pulling apart. Then he released the second dove. It shot toward the channel. Argus counted to 60 before the cliffs slammed shut again. As the clashing rocks separated, the Boreads frantically waved their arms over their heads, the prearranged signal that the bird had made it through safely.
Go!
Jason yelled.
Row! 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 60 seconds!
The Argo lurched forward so quickly the hull groaned. The crew rowed like demons as Orpheus played Shake It Off at double tempo to keep them motivated. The currents helped, pulling the ship into the channel as the cliffs drifted apart. But still, getting through that passage in only a minute seemed impossible. 32 seconds gone, and they were less than halfway. The clashing rocks loomed above, swirling white and yellow teeth of doom. Their deep shadows chilled the sweat on the Argonauts' backs. Rubble showered down to port and starboard. Huge cracks webbed the cliff sides, threatening to rain down curtains of rock. At sea level, the stone was embedded with old timbers and the bones of past crews who had tried to make the passage.
15 seconds left, cried Argus. Faster!
He didn't need to tell them that. The crew was rowing so hard they weren't sure which would break first, their oars or their limbs.
I see the other side,
Calais cried, flying above the mast.
Rumble!
The clashing rocks began to close.
10 seconds!
Yelled Argus. The cliffs groaned. As they slammed shut, snapping the ship's oars, a tidal wave lifted the Argo and carried it out of the channel into the Black Sea.
Yeah!
Jason cheered, but the crew was too shaken up to join him.
That, Argus said, was a little too close.
Fortunately, the ship was still in one piece. The Argonauts could continue their journey as soon as they found new oars and changed their soiled loincloths. For weeks, the Argo skirted the coast and got into all sorts of trouble. They stopped at the island where Atrera had built a temple to Ares, found it defended by killer feather-throwing birds, and barely escaped with their lives. They accidentally landed in Amazon territory and got away just before the Queen's army could catch them. They lost 2 crew members, one to sickness, one to a wild boar attack. They battled monsters, lost their way, ate stale junk food from Anatolian truck stops, and got pulled over at that infamous speed trap on the outskirts of Sinope. After a month of hardship, The Argo finally reached the mouth of the Phasis River, where the towers of Colchis rose on a nearby hill like the hilts of swords sheathed in the earth. Gazing at the warships in the harbor, the town walls, and the fortifications of the palace, Jason realized he could never take this place by force. Even with the best crew and the best ship, he was hopelessly outmatched.
"I'm going to approach the king under a flag of truce," he told his crew. "I'll try to bargain for the fleece."
"What if Aedes captures you and kills you?" Zades asked. "Why would he give up his prized possession?"
Jason managed to smile.
"Hey, if I can work out a deal with Peleus, I can work out a deal with Aedes. I'm an old pro at negotiating with murderous kings."
The Argonauts had to give him full points for bravery, but they were still worried. Jason put on his best robes, the same clothes he'd used to impress the Queen of Lemnos. Then he entered the city with only an honor guard. Meanwhile, up on Mount Olympus, Hera had been following Jason's progress. So far, she was pleased, especially since Hercules was no longer in the picture. Ugh, she hated Hercules. Still, she was worried about Jason's chances with King Aedes. She sat down for a strategy meeting with Athena, who, for once, was on Hera's side. Both goddesses wanted the Golden Fleece back in Greece.
"Jason can never overcome the Colchians by force," Athena said. "There are the dragon, the skeleton warriors, the Colchian fleet."
"Yes," Hera smiled coldly, "but there is also Medea."
"The king's daughter?"
Athena toyed with the Gorgon head pin on her aegis.
"How does that help? She's a sorceress."
"She's a woman,"
Hera said,
"and Jason is a handsome man."
Athena wrinkled her nose.
"You want to get Aphrodite involved? I don't know, Hera. Love is an unreliable motivator."
"Do you have a better idea?"
For a change, Athena didn't. They found the goddess of love in her apartments, where a dozen magical brushes were combing her hair the required 5,000 times to give it that extra bounce and shine.
"Ladies," said Aphrodite, "have you come to take me up on that offer for a pedicure? This is wonderful."
No, Hera said. "Actually, we need a favor. We want to make someone fall in love with Jason."
Aphrodite's eyes gleamed.
"Well, Jason is super hot. That shouldn't be a problem. Who did you have in mind?"
"Medea," Athena said, "the daughter of King Aedes."
"Oh,"
Aphrodite pouted.
"Then we do have a problem. That girl is hopeless. She spends all her time in the Temple of Hecate learning magic. She is cold, heartless, and power-hungry, just like her father. Do you know, one time she conjured Selene down from the moon and made her fall in love with a mortal just to see what would happen?"
"I've heard that story," Athena said. "The characters were interesting, but the plot was a little far-fetched. Anyway, if Medea is messing with love magic, she's trespassing on your territory, isn't she? What better punishment than to make Medea fall in love with her father's enemy?"
Aphrodite shooed away her squadron of magic hairbrushes.
That's true. I'll send Eris down to make Medea fall in love with Jason. But I have to warn you, a love spell on someone like Medea is unpredictable. She'll be just as fierce in romance as she is with her magic. If things go badly between her and Jason, it's worth the risk," Hera said,
proving once and for all that she could not see the future.
"Just cast your magic."
Worst matchmaking ever. Down in the mortal world, Jason was escorted through Aedes' palace. The place was off the hook awesome. Silver and gold doors opened and closed on their own. In the central courtyard, four fountains each spouted a different liquid: water, wine, olive oil, and milk. Why anyone would want that, I'm not sure, but the Argonauts were impressed.
"Dude," muttered Zades, "a milk fountain? This king must have pull with Hephaestus. Only a god could create something as awesome as a milk fountain. And check that out.
Calais pointed. On the other side of a massive hall, in an enclosed pen, two giant bronze bulls were clanking around. Their eyes glowed like lava. Every time they breathed, their nostrils shot flames. Even from across the room, Jason's robes crinkled and steamed from the heat. He began to wonder what he'd been thinking coming to Colchis. Clearly, King Aedes had the edge when it came to cool toys. They found the king seated on a golden throne shaped like a sunburst. He wore golden armor that had once belonged to the war god Ares, which Jason knew because it still said, "Property of Ares," in permanent marker around the collar. At the king's left stood his son, Prince Absyrtus, which sounds like Absyrtus. His oldest daughter, Calliope, which doesn't sound like anything because I can't pronounce it, and the four children she'd had with Phrixus, a.k.a. Curly the Greek, now sadly passed away. On the king's right stood his younger and more dangerous daughter, Medea, priestess of Hecate, stone-cold murderess, all-around party girl. Jason bowed.
"Your Majesty, I am Jason, rightful heir to the throne of Iolcus. I have come to bring the Golden Fleece home to Greece."
His statement was kind of a stupid rhyme, but no one laughed. King Aedes leaned forward. His eyes glittered like obsidian. He examined Jason as if pondering all the interesting ways he could die.
"No Greek has ever sailed to my shores," said Aedes. "I've never even seen a Greek except for Phrixus, who brought us the fleece. To come so far and to ask such a favor, you must be either very brave or very stupid."
Jason shrugged.
"Let's go with brave. The gods want me to succeed. Hera has blessed this voyage. Athena herself designed my ship. Aboard the Argo are demigods of every kind, sons of Boreas, sons of Ares, sons of Zeus. This does not impress me," snarled the king. "I am the son of Helios. We've got one of those two. The point is, my lord, I look around your kingdom, and I can see that the gods favor you. Hephaestus has given you two bronze bulls and fountains that spew oil and milk. Ares has given you a set of hand-me-down armor. I hear he also gave you a sacred grove. Your dad is Helios. Your lovely daughter, I see from her vestments, she is the priestess of Hecate."
While Jason spoke, the love god Eris had been standing invisibly in the crowd, waiting for the right moment. As soon as Jason said,
"Your lovely daughter,"
Eris shot Medea in the heart with an arrow of love, then flew away snickering. Medea's pulse quickened. Her palms turned sweaty. Before, she'd been staring at Jason with contempt. Now, why hadn't she noticed how handsome and noble he was? No one in Colchis would dare stand up to her father that way. Jason's courage was remarkable. Medea's in love with a Greek meter went from 0 to 60 in 3.5 seconds.
"Clearly, sire," Jason continued, "you got where you are today by honoring the gods. So honor their will once more. Give me a chance to prove myself. Assign me any task to win the Golden Fleece."
Aedes tapped his diamond rings against his throne's armrest.
"I could simply kill you now and burn your ship." "But you won't," said Jason, trying to sound confident, "because a wise king would leave the matter to the gods."
Aedes' four grandchildren, the sons of Phrixus, gathered around him and took his hands.
"Please, Granddad," one said. "We're half Greek, too. Dad always told us stories about Greece."
Aedes scowled.
"Your father came here because the Greeks wanted to use him as a human sacrifice."
"But this man is different," said his grandson. "At least give him a chance."
The king shooed them aside. Aedes found the impossible task form of execution unnecessarily complicated, but if it taught his grandchildren a lesson about Greek stupidity, Perhaps it was for the best.
"Very well, Jason," said Aedes. "I won't ask you to do anything I wouldn't do. You mentioned my sacred grove of Ares. Whenever I need extra warriors, I take some teeth from my bucket of discarded dragon incisors."
His grandchildren jumped up and down, clapping in excitement.
"Oh, boy, he's going to do the dragon teeth challenge."
Jason's mouth felt dry.
"You have a bucket of discarded dragon incisors?"
Aedes smiled.
"Well, I have a dragon, so yes. The dragon guards the fleece to protect it from unauthorized visitors. Anyway, I take these old teeth to a field just below the sacred grove. I harness my team of bronze bulls and plow furrows where I plant the teeth like seeds. I water the teeth with a little blood, and presto, a crop of warriors springs from the ground."
Jason blinked.
Okay.
"Tomorrow, you will prove that you are as great a king as I. If you can grow a crop of warriors, you may take the golden fleece and sail back to Greece. If not, well..."
He didn't say, "You will die painfully," but it was sort of implied. Jason felt like asking for a different challenge, perhaps something involving pie eating, but instead he bowed.
"Tomorrow then, sire. With your permission, my men and I will make camp on the shore by your docks."
Jason locked eyes briefly with Medea, maybe because he noticed the strange way she was staring at him. Then he and his guards turned to leave. As soon as possible, Medea fled the throne room. She could barely breathe.
"What is wrong with me?" she hissed, stumbling through the corridors. "I'm not some schoolgirl. I am Medea. How can I feel anything for a man I just met?"
Jason's image burned in her mind. His noble face, his brilliant eyes, the way his lower lip quivered when he said,
okay.
What a man. Medea knew that her father's challenge would be suicide for Jason. She couldn't bear the thought of that brave, handsome Greek being barbecued by the bulls tomorrow morning. In a daze, she ran to the shrine of Hecate deep in the woods. Medea had always found comfort and clarity there before. She stared up at the statue of the goddess, who was depicted with three serene faces, one gazing left, one right, and one center. In Hecate's raised hands, giant torches burned with eternal blue fire.
"Goddess of the crossroads," Medea said. "I need your guidance. I'm in love with Jason, but if I help him, my father will surely find out. He'll banish me or kill me. I'll sacrifice everything."
The statue of Hecate remained silent.
"I want to marry the Greek," Medea said. But why? What's come over me? Would he even love me back? Would he take me away with him? Could I really betray my family and leave my home for a man I barely know?"
Her heart answered, "Yes." The statue continued to stare in three directions, as if to say, "Hey, you're at a crossroads. Deal with it." Medea felt both annoyed and excited.
"Gah! I am a fool. Before I risk my life for Jason, I will make him promise to love me."
She ran back to her magic laboratory and spent hours mixing a special ointment. Then she wrapped herself in a dark robe and sneaked away to the Argonauts' camp. At around 2 a.m, Jason and his advisors were still awake having a strategy meeting. They'd seen those fiery bulls, and the Argonauts were trying to figure out a way to beat Aedes' challenge without Jason being burned alive. So far, their best plan involved 3,000 bags of ice and a large pair of cooking mitts. It wasn't a very good plan. A guard knocked on the tent pole.
Sir? Someone here to see you?
Medea pushed her way inside. The men gasped. The Argonauts were no strangers to scary women. They sailed with Atalanta, But Medea was a different sort of terrifying. The princess's hair was as dark as shadow, tumbling over the shoulders of her black silk dress. On her golden necklace gleamed the symbol of Hecate, two crossed torches. Her expression was remorseless and detached, the way a public executioner might look as he swung his axe. Her eyes flickered with knowledge of dark things, things that would drive most men mad. Yet when she looked at Jason, her cheeks flushed like a girl's.
"I can save you," she said, "but you have to save me."
Jason's pulse hummed in his ears.
"Guys, give us the room."
The Argonauts filed out uneasily. Once they were gone, Medea gripped Jason's hands. Her skin was cold.
"When I saw you, I fell in love instantly. Please tell me I'm not crazy," she begged. "Tell me you felt it too."
Jason wasn't sure what he felt. Medea was beautiful, no doubt about that. The clashing rocks had been kind of beautiful, too.
Wait, what did you mean about saving me?
My father's task is impossible. Surely you know that. No mortal can handle those metal bulls. My father only manages to do so by wearing the armor of Ares. Anyone else would burn to death, but I can stop that from happening.
From her belt, she pulled a small vial of ointment.
If you rub this on your skin before the challenge tomorrow morning, you will be immune to heat and flame. The ointment will also grant you great strength for several hours, hopefully long enough to steer the bulls and plow the field.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Jason reached for the vial, but Medea moved it away.
There is more, she said. If you do manage to sow the field, the dragon teeth will sprout into skeletal warriors. These obey only my father. They will try to kill you, but I can teach you how to defeat them, and after that, there's the matter of stealing the fleece.
But if I win the challenge, Aedes will give me the fleece.
Medea laughed harshly.
My father will never surrender it. If you beat the challenge, he'll simply find another way to kill you, unless you accept my help.
And what do you want in return?
Only your undying love. Swear to me that you will take me back to Greece. Swear by all the gods that you will marry me and never leave me. Promise me that, and I'll do everything in my power to help you. By the way, I have a lot of power.
Jason felt like he was back on Bear Mountain, swinging wildly and blindly in the fog. Marrying Medea would be like marrying a very attractive weapon of mass destruction. Powerful, yes. Safe for long-term exposure? Maybe not so much. But what choice did he have? He couldn't beat this challenge on his own. He had no problem admitting that fact. He'd assembled the Argonauts to help him with his quest. Was recruiting Medea to his cause any different?
I will marry you, he said. By all the gods, I swear. Help me, and I will take you to Greece and never leave you.
Medea threw her arms around him and kissed him. Jason had to admit it wasn't so bad.
Here is the ointment, said Medea. After you've plowed the field, when the skeletons rise from the earth, throw a rock into their midst.
Jason waited.
That's it?
That's it. You'll see. Once they are disposed of and you've won the challenge, my father will be very angry. He'll be tempted to kill you on the spot, but he'll be reluctant to do so in public. Just pretend like nothing is wrong. Tell the king that you'll report to his palace first thing the next morning to claim the fleece.
But he won't actually give me the fleece.
No. He'll wait for you to show up at the palace. Then he'll order you killed. But we won't give him the chance. During the night, have your men secretly make ready to sail. When it gets dark, you and I will sneak into the grove, deal with the dragon, steal the fleece, and get out of here.
Sounds like a plan, sweetheart.
That made Medea very happy. She almost lost the murderous gleam in her eyes.
Good luck, my dearest. Remember your promise.
She didn't say, or else. Like her dad, she was good at just implying the threat. At dawn, Jason reported for duty at the Grove of Ares. As you might guess, the grove was not known for its lovely flowers or tea party gazebos. It sprawled across a terraced hillside outside the city, visible from the entire countryside. The perimeter was lined with iron walls hedged with poisonous thorn bushes. The bronze gates led to a level expanse of dirt the size of a football field, littered with bones and broken weapons. Propped against one wall, tied to a post, was an oversized iron yoke attached to a plow blade bigger than the Argo's keel. The two bronze bulls were romping freely across the field, crushing bones and blowing fire. Farther up the hill stood the grove itself, several acres of dense, twisted oak trees. At the very summit, in the branches of the tallest oak, the golden fleece glittered. From Jason's distance, it appeared no bigger than a postage stamp. It glowed blood red in the morning light, searing his eyes like the beam of a laser pointer, which is really bad to look at. Don't do it. Every person in Colchis seemed to be watching from the nearby hillsides, from the rooftops of the city, even from the masts of ships in the harbor. Jason glanced down at the Argo, anchored near the mouth of the river. He wondered if it was too late to run back to the ship screaming,
"I changed my mind!"
Then King Aedes came thundering down the road in his golden chariot, wearing his hand-me-down, property of Ares, armor. The king looked pretty godlike himself. His helmet's scowling bronze faceplate made Jason shiver. A line of sweat trickled down Jason's face, giving him a whiff of the magical ointment he'd recently applied, sage and cinnamon with just a hint of rancid salamander blood. Gods, he hoped Medea wasn't playing a practical joke on him. The king's chariot rolled to a stop. Aedes glared down at Jason.
"Fool!" bellowed the king, which was how he usually said good morning. "Do you see now how hopeless your task is? Scurry back to your ship. No one will stop you."
Jason wondered if the king could read his mind, or if it was just that obvious how scared he was. Somehow, he mustered his courage.
"I will not back down," he announced. "Where are these dragon teeth you want planted?"
The king snapped his fingers. A servant hustled over and tossed a leather bag at Jason's feet. The contents clattered like pottery shards.
"There you go," said the king. "Good luck harnessing the bulls. I'll be out here riding my chariot, looking cool."
As soon as Jason passed through the gates, they clanged shut. The bronze bulls turned and stared at him.
"Nice bulls," he said. They charged in unison, belching fire. The heat sucked the oxygen out of Jason's lungs.
His eyeballs felt like jalapeno cheese puffs, but amazingly, he didn't die. Godlike strength coursed through his body. He punched the first bull in the face and it toppled sideways. Then he locked his arm around the second bull's neck and dragged it over to the plow. The crowd went nuts, cheering and screaming in disbelief. Jason forced the bull into its yoke, then he went back for the other one. He dragged it to the yoke, manhandled it into its harness, then took the handles of the plow.
"Hiya!"
he yelled. The bulls blew flames at the sky. They pulled the huge plow blade across the dirt, making a furrow. Smoke billowed around Jason. Sparks flew in his eyes. He felt like he was driving a steam train while standing inside the boiler, but somehow he managed to seed the dragon's teeth into the furrows. By noon, the entire field was plowed. Jason still wasn't dead. He parked the bulls, tied them to the post, and decided to take a water break. The Argonauts cheered wildly.
"Not bad for a man," yelled Atalanta.
"That's my boy,"
shouted Polydeuces. Orpheus launched into a song he just made up called Bull-Driving Man, that later topped out at number 5 on the ancient Greek pop charts. Meanwhile, Aedes just stood in his chariot, glaring at Jason. The king's face was hidden behind his visor, but Jason got the feeling Aedes' expression was even less friendly than the metal faceplate scowl.
"A good first start," the king admitted at last. "But now you must reap what you sow. Bring him the blood bucket."
A servant scuttled forward with a lovely green watering can decorated with daisies. The guards opened the gates just long enough to pass it to Jason. He looked inside, saw it was filled with blood, and decided not to ask where that blood had come from. Jason walked along the rows, watering his crop of teeth. As soon as he finished the last section, the entire field rumbled. Skeletal hands erupted from the soil. Dozens of bone warriors clawed their way out, already armed with rusty swords and pitted shields. Their eye sockets were dark and vacant. But when they turned toward Jason, he got the feeling that they could see him just fine. Jason panicked until he remembered Medea's advice. "A rock," he thought. "I need a rock." He found one the size of a baseball and tossed it in a high arc. The skeletal warriors were forming ranks when the stone hit one of them in the head, knocking his helmet off. The warrior stumbled into one of his comrades, who pushed him back, accidentally knocking down a third warrior, whose arms windmilled, smacking a fourth warrior in the face. Pretty soon, all the skeletons were fighting each other, not knowing or caring who had started it. They hacked at each other until the ground was strewn with broken rib cages and decapitated skulls, jaws still clattering. Skeletal arms and legs scissored through the dirt, trying to find their bodies. Jason walked over to the last pair of warriors, both of whom had lost their heads. They were pushing each other in the chest like schoolyard bullies. Jason picked up the nearest sword and chopped their legs off. For a moment, the crowd was silent. Then the Argonauts began to chant,
"Jason! Jason!"
They pushed open the bronze gates and flooded through, lifting Jason onto their shoulders. They paraded him around while Aedes glared balefully.
"Thanks for the challenge, Your Majesty," Jason shouted to the king. "I'll come by the palace tomorrow morning to pick up the fleece. Tonight, we're going to celebrate."
The Argonauts marched back to their camp in a great mood. The Colchians went home and locked their doors. They knew what their king was like when he got angry. As Aedes watched the Argonauts leave, he muttered to himself,
"Party away, Jason. Enjoy your last evening on Earth."
That night, despite his disappointment, Aedes slept very well. There was nothing he looked forward to more than a good massacre. By midnight, most of the Argonauts had returned to the ship in secret, leaving their campfires burning to fool the city watch. Jason stood in his command tent, packing his stuff, when Medea arrived with Aedes' 4 grandchildren.
"They have to come with us," Medea prodded the children forward. "They want to see Greece, where their father was born. Besides, once Aedes discovers we've taken the fleece, they won't be safe. He'll take out his rage on everyone who spoke up for you."
Jason frowned.
"Surely he wouldn't kill his own grandchildren."
"You don't know my father," Medea said.
Jason hadn't planned on taking 4 children aboard the Argo, but he couldn't very well say no. They all looked at him with the big puppy dog eyes, murmuring,
"Please, please, please."
"Fine," he said. "My men will escort you kids to the ship while Medea and I get the fleece."
The Grove of Ares wasn't any less creepy at night. Medea led Jason to a secret entrance in the southern wall. She waved her hand, spoke a few magic words, and the thorn bushes parted, revealing a gap in the iron plating. Severed skeleton limbs were still crawling across the field. Decapitated skulls gleamed in the moonlight.
Bloody mud squished under Jason's sandals and oozed between his toes. When they reached the grove, Medea led him uphill through twisted paths. Jason realized he would have been lost without her. Roots curled around his legs as he stepped, trees shifted, branches poked him in uncomfortable places. Whenever the trees got too aggressive, Medea muttered some magic words and they became still. Finally, they reached the summit. When he encountered the dragon, Jason had intended to draw his sword. Instead, his arms turned to pudding. He could only stare at the slithering mass of reptile with its yellow lamp eyes and sulfurous smoke curling from its nostrils. The creature wound around the tree trunk so many times it was impossible to tell how long it was. Sharp fins lined its back like the edge of a serrated knife. Each of the dragon's scales was as big as a shield, pointed and upturned at the end, so the creature's hide reminded Jason, ridiculously, of a deadly artichoke. When the monster opened its maw, Jason could easily imagine the Argo being swallowed down that red throat, its hull chomped to kindling by the rows of jagged ivory teeth. The dragon's hiss echoed down the hill and reverberated across the valley. There was no way it hadn't woken up everyone in Colchis. Jason almost laughed in despair. What had he been thinking? His sword would be as useful as a toothpick against this beast. Medea gripped his wrist. She pointed to the golden fleece, which glittered in a branch above the dragon's head.
"You'll have to climb the dragon's body to reach it," she said. "Don't fall asleep."
"What?" Medea began to sing. Her words weren't in any language Jason knew, but he caught the name Hypnos, the god of sleep. The song flowed over him like warm honey. His eyes got heavy. Medea dug her fingernails into his forearm to keep him awake. The dragon's eyelids flickered once, twice, then stayed closed. Its massive head sank to the ground and it began to snore, the nostrils pluming sulfur.
"Now," Medea whispered, "hurry."
Medea kept singing as Jason crept forward. He climbed the dragon's back, trying not to impale himself on its pointy scales. Just as he reached the fleece, the dragon writhed in its sleep, almost toppling him. Medea sang a little louder. She inched forward and sprinkled some dust across the dragon's eyes. The monster snored more deeply. Jason had a hard time pulling down the fleece. It was big and heavy, and Phrixus had done a really good job nailing it up there. At last, he tugged it free. The fleece's head flopped over him, nearly braining him with a ram's horn. He made it to the ground just as drums began to echo through the city.
"The guards know," Medea warned. "Hurry!"
They raced through the grove and back across the field of skeletons. Jason was sure they'd be surrounded and captured, but somehow they made it all the way to the docks without being noticed, despite the fact that every guard in the city was now on alert and Jason was running with the shiniest object in the kingdom. By the time Jason and Medea boarded the Argo, Colchian sailors were scrambling to their ships and loading ballistae.
"Go, go, go,"
Jason told his crew. Horns blared. Flaming arrows arced over their heads as the Argo sailed from the harbor, a dozen Colchian ships in hot pursuit. Medea's expression was grave in the torchlight.
"If we're lucky, my brother Absyrtus is leading those ships. At least he will kill us quickly. If my father is on board, well, we would have been better off letting the dragon rip us to shreds."
Medea really had a knack for motivational speeches. The Argonauts rode faster. Just before dawn, Medea managed to summon a fog bank so the Argonauts temporarily lost their pursuers. Since the Colchians weren't sure which direction the Argo had gone, they split into two fleets. After weeks of frantic rowing, the Argo was just approaching the west shore of the Black Sea when one of the Colchian fleets finally caught up with them. From the crow's nest, Jason's lookout reported the colors of the enemy's flags.
"Those are my brother's standards," Medea said. "Absyrtus is leading the ships."
"One more thing,"
called the lookout.
Another Colchian fleet just appeared on the southern horizon. They're about half a day farther away.
Wonderful. Medea puffed a strand of hair out of her face. If they split the fleet, that means my father is in charge of the other group.
The Argonauts were too tired to even curse.
We can't outrun him, Jason said. The crew is exhausted.
I have a plan, Medea said. My brother's ships are closer. We'll negotiate with him before my father gets here.
Negotiate for a faster death?
Medea pointed to the shore.
You see the mouth of that river? That goes inland for hundreds of miles. It might even take us to Greece. Just be ready.
Medea raised a white flag on the mast. At her direction, Jason called across to the Colchian flagship that he wanted to discuss surrender. With a promise of safe passage, Absyrtus and a few guards rowed over to the Argo. That might seem like a stupid thing to do, but back then, people took promises seriously. Welcoming someone onto your ship under a flag of truce was the same as welcoming a guest into your home. You didn't hurt them unless you wanted all the gods mad at you. When Absyrtus saw his sister standing with the Greeks, he shook his head in disgust.
What were you thinking, Medea? You betrayed your homeland for this man?
I'm sorry, brother.
Absyrtus laughed.
Apologies won't help. I'll execute you quickly before father arrives. That's the only mercy I can offer.
You misunderstand, Medea said. I wasn't apologizing for helping Jason. I was apologizing for this.
From beneath her robes, she pulled a dagger and threw it with deadly accuracy. The blade sank into her brother's throat. He collapsed, dead. The prince's guards reached for their weapons, but the Argonauts cut them down. Medea knelt next to her brother's corpse. The crew stared at her in horror.
What have you done? Said Orpheus. Killing an emissary under a flag of truce, and your own brother. You will bring down a curse on all of us.
Medea looked up, her eyes as calm as a vulture's.
Let's worry about the gods later. Right now, we have to escape my father. Jason, help me cut up the prince's body.
Say what now?
There is no time for debate, Medea snarled. The rest of you, to your oars. Row for the river.
By this point, the Argonauts were wishing they'd never heard of Medea, but she was right about having no time to waste. They sailed into the river that would one day be called the Danube. Absyrtus's ships were slow to react. They didn't understand what was going on. The prince didn't usually go sailing with his enemies, but it didn't even occur to the Colchians that the Greeks would have killed him in the middle of negotiations. By the time they sailed in pursuit, they'd lost valuable time. King Aetes's ships caught up with the rest of the fleet, and together they followed the Argo up the river, which is when Medea started tossing Prince Absyrtus's body parts overboard. King Aetes saw his son's right arm go floating by. He roared for the entire fleet to stop. They fished out the arm and scoured the river to make sure they weren't missing anything. Then, and only then, were the Colchian ships allowed to follow their prey. Again, that may sound weird, but the Colchians took their funeral rites seriously. If you wanted your soul to reach the underworld, you had to be buried correctly. First, your corpse was wrapped in oxhide and hung from a tree until your flesh decomposed. Then your skeleton was buried with a bunch of expensive bling while priests chanted prayers to the gods. You couldn't receive a Colchian burial unless your body parts were all accounted for and put together. Otherwise, they'd have to hang you on the tree in a row of little plastic grocery bags, and that would look stupid. Anyway, by leaving a trail of her brother's body parts, Medea bought the Argo enough time to escape. The Danube was a huge river. It had lots of branches, forks, and coves to hide in. By the time Medea threw the last bit of her brother overboard, the Argo had completely lost the Colchians.
There, Medea said,
her face aglow with victory. I told you we would make it. The crew wouldn't even meet her eyes. Jason tried to act grateful, but he was horrified. Who was this woman he had agreed to marry? Now, kids, if you try to sail up the Danube River to get to Greece, you will end up in Germany. But somehow the Argonauts figured out a way. Probably they hauled the ship out of the water at some point, rolled it on logs to another river, then sailed through northern Italy right down to the Adriatic. Along the way, they passed the lake where Phaethon had crash-landed. The Argonauts had been through so much, they just looked at the spot where Phaethon's body was still boiling and fuming under the water, and they thought, yep, that guy got off easy. When they reached the sea, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Monsters attacked. Storms tossed them back and forth. The winds didn't cooperate, and the ship's soft-serve ice cream machine finally broke down.
The gods are punishing us.
Argus glared at Medea.
It's all her fault.
Be quiet, Jason warned. Without Medea, we'd all be dead.
The crew muttered behind Jason's back, but they were too afraid and too dispirited to mutiny. The ship's magical prow had been giving them the silent treatment for weeks. Even the golden fleece, now nailed to the mast, no longer cheered them up. If the fleece had any helpful magic, it sure wasn't sharing it. The Argonauts had a few more close calls. They passed the island of the Sirens, whose magical singing could convince sailors to jump overboard and drown themselves. Fortunately, Orpheus launched into a Jimi Hendrix number that was, like, 3 hours long and drowned out the sirens until the ship was safely out of earshot. They landed at Corfu in western Greece and almost got captured by Colchian bounty hunters, but the local queen stepped in to mediate. She decreed that Medea could not be taken back to Colchis if she was legally married to Jason. The couple got hitched in a hasty ceremony, and the queen let them go. After that, the Argo was tossed around the Mediterranean for weeks until the crew had no idea where they were. Completely out of food and water, they anchored off the shore of an unknown island.
It doesn't matter where this is, Jason said. We have to get supplies.
Jason led the landing party, which included Medea. They were in the woods, filling their jugs at a river, when they heard a strange rumbling sound from the direction they'd come, like massive gears grinding.
What is that?
Asked Polydeuces.
Is Orpheus playing Hendrix again?
The old shipwright Argus turned pale.
That metallic sound, like joints creaking. Oh, gods, no. Could this island be Crete?
From the shore came a massive kasploosh, followed by drumming, as the Argonauts were called to their oars. The landing party dropped their water jars and ran for the beach. When they got to the tree line, they froze in terror. 100 yards away stood a living bronze statue as tall as a castle tower. He was dressed like a warrior. His blank metal face betrayed no emotion, but he was definitely looking at the Argo, which was now rocking in the waves a quarter mile offshore. The giant bronze man knelt and ripped the nearest boulder from the beach, a rock as big as the ship itself. He hurled it toward the Argo. The boulder missed by a few feet, but the wave nearly capsized the boat.
It's Talos, Jason said. He's going to destroy the ship.
What is Talos? Medea demanded. Who in their right mind would make such a thing?
Jason could barely hear her through the ringing in his ears.
Hephaestus made it for King Minos. The statue walks around the island of Crete 3 times a day, guarding against pirates. If Talos sees a ship he doesn't recognize...
My ship! Argus cried. We have to stop him!
Polydeuces pulled the old man back.
That thing is huge. Our weapons won't work against it.
I have an idea, said Medea.
Polydeuces cursed.
I hate it when she says that.
Just listen, I've seen the works of Hephaestus before. Usually, they are animated with molten lead for blood. There should be a safety valve from when the statue was first filled up.
There,
Jason pointed. Sure enough, on the statue's left heel was a circular plug the size of a shield.
I will distract the statue, Medea said. You run out and open that valve.
Before they could debate the matter, Medea sprinted across the beach. The statue Talos picked up another boulder. He lifted it to throw just as Medea began to sing. Talos turned and stared down at her. Medea's voice didn't waver. She invoked the god Hypnos and sang of cold forges, well-oiled joints, comfy metal blankets, and whatever else giant bronze statues might dream about. Talos could have dropped the rock and crushed her flat, which would have saved Jason a lot of trouble later on. Instead, the statue listened, confused and sluggish. Jason skirted the beach and ran up behind the monster. He jammed his sword into the edge of the plug and popped it open, breaking his blade in the process. Molten lead almost incinerated him. He leaped sideways, his clothes peppered with steaming holes as the statue's blood gushed out, turning the beach into the world's largest lead mirror. Talos reeled and stumbled. The giant dropped his boulder and fell face first, hitting the ground so hard that Jason's teeth shook and his eyeballs rattled. When Jason came to his senses, Medea was standing over him smiling.
Well done, husband. Can I interest you in a few million pounds of scrap metal?
The Argonauts gathered food and water and sailed for home before old King Minos could figure out who broke his favorite toy soldier. Finally, after what seemed like years, because it had been years, the Argo reached home and docked at Iolcus. The locals held a huge party for the returning Argonauts. They paraded down Main Street with the Golden Fleece and hung it in the town square. Jason and Medea went to the palace in triumph, where old King Peleus was not exactly thrilled to see them.
Well done, he said half-heartedly. So, okay then. Thanks for bringing us the fleece.
My throne, said Jason. That was the deal.
Yes. The throne.
Peleus winced.
Okay, no problem. When I die, you will be the next king.
What?
Cried his son Acastus.
What?
Cried Jason.
Let the festivities begin, said Peleus.
Jason was steamed. He'd done everything Peleus had asked, but Peleus had never specified exactly when he would give Jason the throne, so now he had to wait for who knew how long.
You could take the throne by force, Medea urged.
Jason scowled.
This isn't Colchis. We don't kill each other in cold blood. Well, not as often, anyway.
Fine, Medea said. I'm sure the old man will die soon anyway.
Medea's tone should have warned Jason that she was planning something, but I guess he didn't want to know. A few weeks later, after the partying had settled down and Medea and Jason had moved into guest rooms at the palace, Jason's father, Aeson, toddled into the city for a visit, though he was now old and feeble. Medea welcomed him with a special gift. She whipped up a potion that rejuvenated his joints, strengthened his muscles, and added about 10 years to his life. At the end of his visit, the old guy threw away his cane and decided to jog home. The daughters of King Peleus were so impressed they went to see Medea.
Wow, your magic is amazing, said Alcestis, one of the princesses.
Medea smiled.
Thank you, dear. Could you do that for our dad?
Alcestis asked.
The poor guy has really bad arthritis and boils and gout and about a dozen other problems. We'd love to make him younger as a surprise birthday present.
How sweet.
Medea's mind whirled with possibilities.
Alas, you wouldn't like the way the potion is administered. It takes great courage and a strong stomach to do what is necessary.
Alcestis and the other princesses looked offended.
We are courageous.
Medea pretended to think about it. I will show you what must be done, but I'm warning you, it isn't pretty. She took the princesses to her newly set up laboratory. She asked the guards to bring her an old goat from the royal pens. Meanwhile, she set a huge pot over the fire, filled it with water, and brought it to a boil. She muttered a few spells and sprinkled in some magic herbs. The guards brought her a goat so old it could hardly stand. Its eyes were milky with cataracts. Its fur was falling out in tufts.
Pretend this goat is your father, Medea told the princesses.
She took out her knife and slit its throat. Then she hacked the goat to pieces.
What are you doing?
Shrieked Alcestis. Medea looked up with blood on her face.
I told you it wasn't easy. Just watch.
She gathered up the pieces of the goat and threw them in the boiling water. The pot trembled.
A young goat sprang out, steaming and bleating and prancing around like, ow, ow, hot. That's amazing, said Alcestis. Yes, Medea sighed. It's too bad you would never have the courage to do this for your father. If you did, he would live another 40 or 50 years. We have the courage, said Alcestis. Give us the magic.
Medea fixed up a bag of harmless herbs, rosemary, thyme, a little meat tenderizer.
Here you go. Good luck.
That night, the four princesses prepared a huge pot of boiling water in the royal kitchen. They told their father they had a special birthday surprise for him. They blindfolded Peleus and led him down to the kitchen. Peleus chuckled, expecting some cookies or maybe a badly decorated cake.
Oh, girls, you shouldn't have.
Surprise!
Alcestis removed his blindfold. The king saw his four daughters standing in front of a boiling pot of water. Each of them was grinning and holding a large knife.
Girls?
Happy birthday!
The princesses fell on their father and chopped him to pieces. They threw him in the pot with the herbs and spices and waited for him to leap out young and strong. Instead, they made a pot of Peleus stew. When they realized they'd been tricked, they wailed and moaned. They told everyone that Medea had given them the idea. Since nobody in Iolcus liked Medea, they turned on her. Jason was horrified. He tried to distance himself from his wife. He swore he had nothing to do with the murder plot. But it was too late. No one could stand the idea of Jason being king after what his wife had done. He and Medea were forced to flee the city to avoid getting lynched by an angry mob. Jason had finally realized his dream. He had united the city by bringing home the Golden Fleece. He had united them against him. Acastus, Peleus's son, became the king. Jason and Medea were given refuge in the city of Corinth, where King Creon was a big fan of the Argonauts' adventures. He actually believed Jason's innocence in the infamous cooking pot scandal. Jason and Medea had two children, both cute little boys. Medea reconstructed her secret laboratory and fashioned spells and potions for the locals. The people of Corinth were nicer to her, though they still found her creepy. That didn't get any better when Medea's grandfather, Helios, gave her a new chariot for her birthday. Why Helios thought that was a good idea, I don't know, but this magical chariot came complete with two dragons. Medea flew it all over town when she needed to get groceries or take the kids to soccer practice, and it really made the Corinthians nervous. Nobody called her the mother of dragons. It just didn't happen. As for Jason, he became King Creon's best general. The royal family thought he was great, but the king could tell Jason was sad in his heart.
My boy, said Creon, it's clear that your sorceress wife is causing you grief. You can't possibly love her. She cost you your rightful kingdom. She's not even Greek.
You need to put her aside. Marry my daughter, Creusa. I will make you my heir, and you'll be a king as you should be.
The first few times the king offered, Jason said no. He'd made a promise to Medea after all, but over the months, his willpower crumbled. He started finding reasons to justify what he wanted. Funny how people can do that. Oh, it'll be better for Medea too, he thought. I can give her a nice alimony and child support. She can marry someone more compatible, a warlock or a murderer or something. Finally, he signed a deal with King Creon. The wedding date was set. Jason convinced himself that Medea would be happy and relieved. He came home with a grin on his face and told her all about it. He lectured her about why, really, this was good for both of them.
I see. Medea's voice was like permafrost. And you won't change your mind?
No, afraid not. But hey, you and the boys will be well taken care of. I hope you'll come to the wedding.
Oh, absolutely, said Medea. I will even send your bride a gift.
Wow, thanks for being so cool about this.
Which goes to show Jason never knew his wife at all. Medea sent Princess Creusa a poisonous wedding gown. It was the most beautiful thing Creusa had ever seen. She tried it on immediately and began to smoke and scream. She ran through the halls, her skin bubbling, her arms on fire. King Creon tried to help her and got stuck to the dress, so both father and daughter died together in misery. When Jason heard about this, he ran home screaming,
Medea! What have you done?
He was followed by a crowd of angry Corinthians with torches and pitchforks, and they weren't on his side. Jason burst through the door, and his heart nearly exploded. His two sons were lying dead on the floor, Medea standing over them with a knife.
Our boys? Jason sobbed. Why? They didn't do anything.
You caused this, Medea snarled. You would be nothing without me. I left my home for you. I did everything for you. You promised to all the gods that you would love me forever, and you broke your word. I want you to suffer, Jason. I want to take away everything that matters to you. Farewell, ex-husband. I hope you die alone and in misery.
Before Jason could recover his senses, Medea hopped in her dragon-powered chariot and flew away. Jason didn't even have time to bury his children before the mob stormed his house and he was forced to flee Corinth. Medea flew to Athens, where she had a whole new set of adventures as Theseus's evil stepmother. Later, she returned to Colchis, found that her father Aedes had died, and took over the throne. Why the Colchians wanted her back? I don't know. Maybe she had proven that she was just the kind of queen they needed. As for Jason, he wandered Greece alone and miserable. Finally, so old and crippled and gray that nobody recognized him, he returned to Iolcus, where the Argo was rotting at the docks. The ship had once been the pride of the city, a reminder of their greatest hero. But since the business with Medea, nobody liked to think about the Argonauts or Jason or even the Golden Fleece, which had been put in storage in the palace basement. The Argo had an evil reputation. It had been left to the Vandals and graffiti artists. Jason crawled aboard and huddled under the magical prow.
You're my only friend, he told the ship. You understand me.
But the magical wood from Dodona had stopped talking years ago. That night, as Jason slept, the prow rotted through, fell on Jason's head, and killed him. So the Argonaut dream team was forgotten. Their quest had been all for nothing. Their great leader, Jason, died alone and despised. And if that isn't a great ending for this book, I don't know what is. Makes you want to run right out and become a Greek hero, doesn't it? At least we learn some important things along the way, like, don't abandon your kid in the wilderness, don't make out in a god's temple, don't mix orange and lime green, avoid Hera at all costs. But like I told you guys years ago, this demigod gig is dangerous. Don't say, I didn't warn you. Afterward. Dude, what time is it? I'm late for our monthly Argo 2 reunion party. I am so dead. Writing this book took a lot longer than I expected, but I hope it was worth it for you. Maybe it'll save your life. Or at least lay out your options for painful and interesting ways to die. I also hope my lifetime supply of pizza and blue jelly beans start soon. I am starving. After reading all this, if you're still determined to be a hero, you are beyond hope. Then again, I'm beyond hope, and so are most of my friends. So, I guess, welcome to the club. Keep your sword sharp, guys. Keep your eyes open, and if you insist on visiting the Oracle at Delphi, well, then, have a nice day. Peace from Manhattan, Percy Jackson.
This is Jesse Bernstein. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Percy Jackson's Greek Heroes by Rick Riordan. This program was directed by Arthur Gianzana. Executive Producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2015 by Rick Riordan. Production copyright 2015, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.